we're going to get started, everybody. We've only got an hour, so we want to try and make the most of our time together, because we've got some fantastic presentations for you, and we want to leave time for a decent discussion. Well done for coming up front. The front row empty of these things. Broken the trend there. Well done. So my name's Rick Henderson, and I am the chief executive of Homeless Link, and now also Citra. Some of you may or may not know that Citra is now part of Homeless Link, so I guess that makes me the group chief exec. Only a few weeks ago, I'm still getting used to it. But we're one of the sort of sponsors of the of this conference, have been for the last few years. I think it's a fantastic event. Homeless Link is the sort of umbrella body for homeless organisations in England, so I'm very pleased to be able to co-chair this session with my new friend Joseph, who's going to introduce himself now.
My name's Joseph, I'm an EBE with Pathways, here to co-chair the meeting. Today we have Alicia Teixeira talking about homeless people's experience of benefit sanctions with the DWP, and we have Cole Mason talking about homeless access to social services. You want to start?
Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming. These are very worrying times for anyone interested in homelessness, and I'm assuming all of you are. Why? Because for the past 5 years, over 5 years now, all types of homelessness have been going up. And one of the things we're being very concerned about at crisis are how sanctions and conditionality are having an impact on those trends. In particular, since a harsher regime of conditionality was introduced in the Welfare Reform Act 2012. So we felt that the most vulnerable groups, people like homeless people, were going to have be very much affected. However, the evidence was very few and far between. There were lots of reports in the press, but we needed the hard evidence to take to government to make the case for improvements to the system to be made. Some things also popped up in the Oakley Review, the Work and Pensions Committee, but there had been no research focusing on homeless people in particular. So what we decided to do was to invest in the largest study of its type in the country, and we knew from the very beginning that it needed to be independent, because otherwise the evidence would have been dismissed. So we invested in a very large study. We worked with Sheffield Hallam, who coincidentally also work with the DWP quite a bit. And we had two main aims. We wanted to look at the prevalence, how commonly were people sanctioned, and also we wanted to know what their experiences were, what the impact was on their lives. So what did we do? We did surveys with over 1,000 people in England and Scotland. We also did in-depth interviews with 42 service users to look more in-depth at their pathways and the experiences. And we did a number of stakeholder consultations. So sadly, though we tried quite a lot, we never got around to talking to the DWP or Job Centre Plus or work program providers, and we tried. It wasn't for lack of trying. But sadly, we weren't able to triangulate the data. So, research findings, what did we find? Let's split it in two, prevalence and reasons for sanctions, and then afterwards we'll look at the impact on people's lives. So prevalence, we found that 39% of survey respondents who were subject to conditionality had been sanctioned. So this is a lot higher than the annual sanction rate for JSA claimants, which is only 18%. What's also really interesting is that if you look at the general claimant population, people on JSA are much more likely to be sanctioned than people on the SA RAG. This was not the case when it came to our study. It was actually very similar, the similar levels, which is a bit of a concern. Also a huge concern was that the people in our cohort with the highest needs were also more likely to have been sanctioned, so people with mental ill health, care leavers, etc. We also found that 40% of people, as many as that, have been sanctioned more than once in the past 12 months. So that's seriously disrupted. So we can now really say on the back of some very strong evidence that homelessness service users are definitely being disproportionately affected by sanctions. And what's really interesting, though, is, and it's important to mention, is that the DWP really wants to make sure that the conditions imposed on claimants are reasonable and that the claimant commitment is tailored to the needs and to the circumstances of the claimant. So that's definitely what the policy says, and it's important to acknowledge that. So, as they say, any work-related requirement placed on claimants should be personalised according to their needs and circumstances, taking into account any restrictions. This is what the DWP says. However, in our study, what we found is that the majority of people found it very, very difficult to meet their conditionality requirements. And also the claimant commitment that if you talk to the DWP, they'll say that they're definitely tailored to the needs of the individual. This was not happening to the people that took part in our study. They felt that the claimant commitment was very one-sided. They felt that a lot of the time the advisors weren't listening to them. They weren't listening to what they wanted to do, to the work experience they had. They weren't dealing with them as individuals, which is what's meant to be happening. It's definitely what's meant to be happening, but with our client group, for whatever reason, it isn't. Also, I have some copies of the report here. We have example after example of people being expected to do a number of things that you wouldn't expect someone who's sort of rough sleeping to do, like searching for over 30 jobs, apply for over 30 jobs a week when they have nowhere to sleep. That wasn't uncommon. People who were being evicted, but if they missed an appointment would then be sanctioned. Those examples are not uncommon. So why is our sanction rate so high? Is it because people didn't want to comply? Definitely not. So what we found, which is really interesting, is that people they believed in the system in a way, not in sanctions, but certainly in conditionality. They believed that they shouldn't get something for nothing. That was really fascinating. They really felt, and in any case, people were highly motivated to work. People very often had suffered from very ill health, and they still wanted to be on GSA. Everyone around them, including the advisors, were saying, you should go for ESA, and they just wanted to be on GSA because they were so keen to work, sometimes to the detriment of their own health. So people, actually, we found, were generally very motivated to work. So what is actually going on? On the left here, you can see how the type of thing that made it difficult for them to comply. Practical things like not having money to travel to an appointment, appointments that clash. Actually, homeless people are very busy. I don't think people often appreciate it. They really are. All the practicalities are, you need to go and sign on, you need to go and see your key worker, you need to go to a doctor's appointment. It's very, very difficult, especially if you don't have the money to travel between all these appointments to make it. Access to the internet, that was a theme running throughout, very difficult. Access to the internet as well as the ability to use the internet in the first place, and computers, not being familiar with the technology. Basic things like, the letters not arriving on time or going missing, that was another very common thing. Often people say that they didn't receive the letters they're supposed to have received, so no wonder they missed the appointments. The other thing that made it very difficult for them, apart from the circumstances, are support needs. So people were very vulnerable, and it's important to remember that. So many people had drug and alcohol issues, reported mental ill health. 25% had literacy difficulties. So all of those things meant that people found it very difficult to comply with their requirements. And so why did they end up being sanctioned? Because by far the most common reason was because they didn't make it to a work-focused interview. So they missed an appointment, either because they didn't receive a letter or because their personal circumstances made it very difficult. And we can group them into five categories broadly. Impossible to comply. So some people are in hospital. They were in hospital, hospitalized when they missed the appointment. And even though they explained this to the advisor, they were still sanctioned. We have a number of examples. Again, look at the report. Making difficult choices. So some people have had a job interview. That's why they missed their appointment. And somehow they were still sanctioned. And some people were about to be evicted, as I said before. Oversights and the misunderstandings. Lots of people talk very candidly about how they just forgot their appointment. I mean, all of us do that type of thing from time to time. If people are living under very difficult circumstances and have vulnerabilities, it's no surprise this is also happening. So people make honest mistakes, and there's not much sympathy when that happens. We mentioned support needs, how that limits people's ability to meet the requirements, and very, very rarely people refuse to comply. This was very unusual. So only two respondents of the people we did in-depth interviews with, only three people fitted into that category. So a key finding is very much the fact that people want to comply. People do believe in doing something. That people want to better themselves. People want to get a job anyway, independently of whether they're claiming benefits or not. But there are systemic barriers and personal barriers preventing them from doing so. And what impact? What are the consequences of those sanctions? And this is where it gets quite worrying. Not so much the intended consequences. So first we wanted to look at the intended consequences because the policy wants to achieve an effect. So the effect they wanted to achieve was motivating people to get a job, essentially. So we first looked, does the policy do what it set out to achieve? It doesn't necessarily mean that people get jobs, but certainly people, what we found is that people are more likely to comply. So they reported that they're more likely to turn up on time. Whether it's the threat of sanctions or being sanctioned, the experience of being sanctioned, it does mean that people are more likely to comply. Does this result in a positive outcome? No, but certainly they tick some of the other boxes, which is really fascinating. Though if you notice, the threat is more effective than the sanction itself, which is something to take away. Unintended consequences. This is where it gets very, very worrying indeed. The many unintended consequences of the policy. So we had many, many reports of people going hungry, having to skip meals, going without heating, having to borrow money from friends and families. And of course, the friends and families sometimes can barely afford to do that. Having to rely on charities, there was a lot of that going on, having to rely on charities for food and other types of support, stealing, begging, and having to take loans from loan sharks. And very, very worrying as well was the fact that all of these things meant that then people's health, both physical and mental, quickly deteriorated. So these are very vulnerable individuals. So it doesn't take that much to then push them to the edge. And this is what sanctions seem to be doing. You know, a lot of the time, the income from benefits, it's all that people have. You take that away, and you put lots of pressure on people's lives. And this is what we found. And we found that only 70% of people reported that both mental health and physical health deteriorated after being sanctioned. We also found that 21%, as many as 21%, said that they became homeless as a direct result of being sanctioned. So not only were sanctions pushing people who were already homeless further away from the labour market and further away from homelessness, but it was they're causing homelessness. So, which is a very important finding. And this quote sums it up perfectly from Ross, not his real name. Sanctions are just the icing on the cake. That's when you're homeless and you're penniless. You're homeless, you're on the bottom of the breadline, then they punish you for being on the bottom of the breadline and being homeless by taking your money away from you. Therefore, you can't better yourself, you can't go no further, and your health starts going down the drain. This was very, very common. This is not, many people said things like that to us. And what it means is that people who are actually relatively work ready at the beginning, at the beginning of the process, are further away from the labour market, which is ironic because that's the opposite effect of the policy. So just final reflections. For us, all these findings show very clearly that conditionality and sanctions are not working for our client group. We're not commenting about the system in general. We looked at service users of homelessness service users. It's not working well for them at all. They are meant to be a last resort sanctions. They're meant to be a last resort, but 39% of people had been sanctioned. And also, they were not just being imposed on people who would not cooperate. They were being imposed on people who could not comply because of their personal circumstances. And what's particularly concerning for us is that it's pushing them further away from recovering from homelessness. It's pushing them further away from the labour market. So that's very, very concerning indeed. The report, we drew a lot of recommendations from the report. I won't go through them one by one. But for us, really key is that people's housing benefit is not stopped as a result of being sanctioned. This is not meant to be happening anyway, but we have evidence that it is happening. Also, the conditionality requirements should be suspended if people are homeless. But this means that the assessment that people receive at the beginning of the process is really thorough. Homeless people are identified as early as possible, and that information is reviewed at regular intervals. So you capture whether people's circumstances have changed, and the claimant commitment needs to be more tailored to the individual. This is already meant to be happening. Our report shows that it's not happening in practice. Something needs to change, and finally, the DWP really needs to start evaluating the system on a regular basis. Because you can't shy away from the impact something like this is having on the most vulnerable in society. And that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Just while the next presentation is loading up, I mean, we looked at this issue of Homeless Link as well. We ran some focus groups with Job Centre Plus staff, and what we discovered, and it was quite disturbing actually, was just how little Job Centre Plus staff understood about homelessness. In fact, they didn't. Their understanding of homelessness was basically no more or less sophisticated than the average member of the public. They received no training in homelessness. They often said that they could get through an entire interview with a person without knowing or realising that the person was homeless. And this made it very difficult to do that thing that they meant to do, which is provide the tailored service. So one of the things that we did through that work was to kind of put the message out to some of our members, homelessness organisations, that it was probably better for the claimant to let their advisor know that they were homeless at the start of the interview, mm-hmm. which a lot of people weren't doing as a matter of routine. In fact, what they were doing was the opposite. They were kind of hiding the truth mm-hmm. of their circumstances. Joseph?
In my personal experience, I have come across several job centres who refuse to allow you to claim benefits if you say you are homeless. They insist that you have a care of address, which, with a care of address on the system, you are not registered with them as homeless, and they will not allow you to actually create a claim while you are NFA without a care of address. So, the system seems to be built in a way that is beneficial to them, and it doesn't really matter to them that it's so detrimental to some other people. So,
right. So what we're going to do, we're going to crack on with the second presentation, then that will give us plenty of time for a discussion. So kind of hold your thoughts on the issue of the sanctions. I'm sure you have experiences that you might want to share, but we will now hear from Carmen about the CARE Act and its implications.
Thanks very much. Oops. Reshuffling. Morning, everyone. Really nice to be here. I was invited by Pathway to talk through the CARE Act 2014 and its implications for practice with homeless people. I sort of would like to preface this talk by saying I'm not a solicitor or a lawyer or a legal expert. I'm a social worker who manages one of the Pathway homeless teams at King's. I suppose it's important to sort of put that on the table. And really, I suppose, as a social worker managing a pathway team, I, along with many of you, have had to grapple with this new landscape for social care. Sorry, I put my mobile on the table to help me with timing, but it's just started to ring, so maybe I'll just ignore that. So yeah, I've had to grapple with this new world of social care since its implementation, and it's only 11 months ago that this was implemented, really, so it's quite new. And I suppose during the course of the year, I've done some CPD sessions, and this talk is particularly linked to a CPD session I did for the London Homeless Nurses Network meeting last summer. Which was quite interesting. One big limitation here is the absence of a body of case law. We only have one piece of case law following the Care Act. And obviously case law is often what helps us to understand the nuances and interpret the legislation. However, although it's been slow to roll out, the one piece of case law that we do have shows some sort of cause for optimism around the finding that the local authority in question didn't consider accommodation-related support, care and support. So that's quite interesting. But this optimism isn't necessarily reflected in all analyses of the implications of the Care Act, because the Care Act is obviously being implemented at a time that coincides with great amounts of cuts in the public sector and in local authorities, and alongside the climate of austerity, which really will have an impact in relation to how it's rolled out. Another big limitation is trying to cover this in 15 minutes or 20 minutes. So I'm not going to say that this is a comprehensive overview of the Care Act. It's not. It's looking at some key sections and trying to build on the implications in them. So just to say, some of you will be aware of the previous legislation that we've had in community care. And the Care Act 2014 is the most significant piece of legislation in the social care sector. And for people who have got social care needs since the welfare state was established following World War II, and just as the 1948 National Assistance Act revolutionised the provision of support for vulnerable adults following the poor laws, which were obviously handed down from Victorian times, the Care Act has swept aside huge swathes of community care legislation, which for many of us would be common household names, really. So a huge sea change for community care law. And as I said, just 11 months old in terms of its implementation. The aim of it was to consolidate this patchwork of old community care laws and to update some of the terminology and some of the processes. And a key driver was obviously the changes in demographics and the ageing population. But also it continues to roll out some key policy themes from the last 20 years or so, particularly person-centred approaches and personalisation. Let's see. Yeah, I want to warn really that although there are some helpful nods to the homeless sector, this act doesn't at all constitute a new deal for homeless people or the professionals who work with them. Rather, in the words of Michelle Corns and her colleagues, it provides some useful and possible tentative windows through which homeless people may access services, and there should be and the way that they're approached by social care. So the terminology of the Act is the first really significant thing, because anybody who practiced under the old regime will remember the definition of disability in the 1948 National Assistance Act. People remember the Chronically Sick and Disabled Persons Act. And previous Community Care Acts referred to the people who might receive services, disabled, elderly, ill, but no more. The Care Act actually refers to adults. Brilliant. And it refers to carers, and it refers to individuals who could be adults or carers. And that is certainly a potential window for the homeless sector and for homeless people, because it removes the reference to non-eligible and non-eligible groups. And therefore, homeless people may be able to access social care in an easier way. And I think generally speaking, one of the implications is of the terminology in the Care Act is that we as a group have to become familiar with the new language of the new landscape of social care law, not just in terms of this terminology, but in terms of properly advocating for our clients to the local authority, understanding what we're asking for and how it's phrased in this new Act. So, well-being is the first section of the Act, and well-being is basically, it's a rather sort of vague construct, but it's a general duty that the local authority have, and it, basically they set out what well-being might include, which is these nine elements or aspects. Great to see dignity there, and great also to see participating in work, education, training, recreation, social and economic well-being, and particularly homeless sector. People might be interested in the fact that suitability of living and accommodation is linked to well-being. That's really rather significant. This is a general duty under the Act, and it also acts as a principle the principle acts as a thread throughout the Act, which must be sort of considered whenever the local authority is discharging its duties under the Care Act. So that might be at the assessment stage, considering eligibility, safeguarding, duties towards carers, etc., etc. So well-being is really rather important, and we'll come back to these nine aspects when considering eligibility in just a minute. Just to scan over very briefly some of these other sections. So there's a new duty on the local authority to provide information and advice, and that must cover new entitlements, including financial advice. Information should be provided in an accessible way, not just linking to websites or signposting to websites. Any of us who call local authority social care telephone numbers these days know the emphasis with the teleprompter trying to divert you to information services rather than actually speaking to somebody in the social care hub. But I suppose the implication of that is a finding of ineligibility for our clients should still lead to the provision of information. And it can also, ineligibility can also lead to a power to provide services to non-eligible needs, apart from the information and advice piece. Integration and cooperation is rather important for those of you working in hospital discharge services. And for example the pathway teams. Basically it's a big emphasis, and the reason for this big emphasis is obviously the pressures on the NHS sector and the needs for better integration with social care. What's quite important here is the potential. I know Jane has spoken about this before, the potential of the Better Care Fund, which is a pooled fund to help with integrated care. And the potential of that to perhaps fund discharge type services for homeless people discharge support services. That's a possible use of it. And I suppose the other implication is for anybody working in hospitals is that we should be seeing better better intra-local authority working arrangements between housing and social care within the one borough, which oftentimes you would think that they belong to completely different organisations, but also implications for hospital discharge teams in relation to health and social care, and seeing sort of embedded posts and things like that being funded. Again, there's duties towards carers, which I'm not going to look at in big detail, but this is quite a big change, and the trigger for a carer assessment is not calling up the local authority and saying, I'd like a carer's assessment. It's the appearance of need. And the assessment has to ascertain whether or not the carer is able or willing to provide the care, as well as a range of other things. And I suppose the implication for these new carer's duties, which I can't go into detail here, is that actually, through providing support for carers, might we be able to prevent certain types of homelessness potentially? And one important thing is that even if the adult is not eligible for social care, the carer might be. So it's a splitting out of adults and carers. And carers are not, their eligibility is not intrinsically linked to the eligibility of the adult that they're caring for. It's rather important. And it links with the overall theme of prevention, reducing and delaying under Section 2 of the Care Act. Safeguarding. This is the first time that adult safeguarding has been enshrined in law, and that's really very, very important. Its inclusion is in the context of a national 13% increase in safeguarding referrals to local authorities between 2011 and 2013. And of those referrals, only 43% are generally substantiated. So enshrining safeguarding in the law is really quite important. The statutory guidance, well, the Care Act itself only really defines abuse in relation to financial abuse, but the statutory guidance, Chapter 14, is actually the Bible for safeguarding now, because it repeals and replaces No Secrets, which some of you will be familiar with. So No Secrets is no more. And now we need to be referring to Chapter 14 of the Care and Support Statutory Guidance. Proportionality and person-centred approaches are key, and the Care Act statutory guidance outlines not only the four categories of abuse that we see in child protection, plus the three that came out through the SKY, financial, institutional, discriminatory, but also these three new ones, which were quite controversial when they came out. So modern slavery is quite important for us as a homosexual. I know certainly we in Pathway come across trafficking all the time, so that's quite important. Domestic abuse, again, it's good to see it there. And self-neglect, which was most controversial of all, given that previously safeguarding required for there to be a perpetrator, which wasn't the person self-neglecting. So that's quite interesting as well. Independent advocacy. Now, I'm no football fan, but anybody who is might recognise a famous formation here, and I think that's quite a helpful way of remembering the need for independent advocacy. Although it's a new and really, really interesting and useful provision in the Act, and it's a duty, by the way, early reports are that local authorities are not referring when they should be. And the one piece of case law that we have, and we'll come on to that later, suggests that in fact this wasn't being managed very well by the local authorities. So who should have an independent advocate? Well, there are four groups: adults in need of care and support, carers, children approaching transition, and the parents of children approaching transition. When should they receive it? At four stages of the care planning process: assessment, care and support planning, review, and safeguarding. And the considerations for who should be referred to an advocate: it's people who might have substantial difficulty engaging with the process that's here in the purple line, and also somebody who doesn't have anybody appropriate to advocate for them. It's not the same as the IMCA, because the IMCA is about substitute decision making under the Mental Capacity Act, whereas this is about supported decision making. However, if somebody needs an IMCA as well, it would probably make sense for that to be the same person, but there's relatively little sort of written about this yet, given it's quite new, so we'll have to see how it pans out. But basically, it's really important for you guys to know about this in terms of being able to hold the local authority to account and say, you know, what about referring to an independent advocate? Okay, very briefly to look at assessment, which is covered in Section 9 and care and support planning. So the duty to assess is much the same as under the NHS Community Care Act. It's the appearance of need. But the Care Act suggests that the local authority must consider mental capacity, advocacy and participation support, impact on carers and the family, safeguarding. They must use a strengths-based approach, good news, and they must be proportionate, and the assessment methods must be appropriate. There is a power to meet urgent need without doing an assessment, and an assessment can be refused, bearing in mind mental capacity. Now, in previous acts, we had a prescriptive list of what could be provided. We don't have that anymore. We have this illustrative list, which includes accommodation in a care home or in premises of some other type, which is quite interesting. It doesn't include adaptations, travel, holidays, which we saw in some of the earlier community care laws, but that doesn't matter so much because it's an illustrative list, and in fact, apart from eligibility guidelines, you could even see things like computer games being provided to people. It's whatever the person needs, but obviously eligibility comes into it. Okay, speaking of eligibility, it's a three-step process, and essentially eligibility is based on, well, the first thing is to determine whether or not the need arises due to a physical or mental impairment or illness. The second thing to decide is whether or not two or more outcomes are met, and we'll come on to outcomes on the next slide. And then the third step is to consider whether or not there's a significant impact on the person's well-being as a result of not being able to achieve those two or more outcomes. These outcomes are laid out here, And it's quite interesting to see maintaining a habitable home environment, which many of you might say, great, that's wonderful, that's every single person that we work with. What I would say, though, is this is quite important, that due to physical or mental impairment or illness, so those, the ability to meet the outcomes must be as a result of a physical or mental impairment or illness, not homelessness. Now, homeless people are likely to have a range of morbidities that might throw them through this net, but it's not quite as simple as saying, well, they're homeless, and of course homeless people can't maintain a habitable home environment. This has to be as a result of the condition, which is physical or mental health. Okay. Let me see what else I wanted to say here. Yeah, in terms of unable to achieve, what does that mean? So that could be somebody who's unable to achieve the outcome without assistance, or that they can't do it without incurring significant pain, distress, or anxiety, that they might be able to achieve the outcome without assistance, but in doing so endangers them or is likely to endanger the health and safety of another adult or somebody else. And they might be able to achieve the outcome without assistance, but it takes significantly longer than would normally be expected. So that's what unable to achieve any of these are. And then in terms of the significant impact on well-being, local authorities need to decide whether or not the adult's needs impact on an area of well-being in a significant way, or the cumulative impact of the impact on a number of the areas of well-being. So the areas of well-being are, going back to the first slide I had, the aspects of well-being under section one. Now again, the implications for eligibility are, we have to see how it goes really, because homelessness itself, as I said, isn't a trigger, it's the health condition. And alongside austerity, we're not sure how this is going to manifest itself. It would be interesting to hear in sort of discussion time how people are finding eligibility decisions being made by local authorities, and I'm sure there's some difference. Ordinary residents. Just to say that the CAREC does talk about ordinary residents. A lot of it is around portability of care packages when somebody moves from London to Manchester, for example, and is already in receipt of care, or the continuity of responsibility when somebody's living in supported living premises. It also talks about cross-border placements, or if there is some business failure, like a care home shutting down. But in terms of the ordinary residence test, essentially it remains the same as under previous legislation, but just confirms it. And again, it goes back to sort of that SHA test finding, where basically ordinary residence is where the adult has been living in an area on a voluntary basis and for settled purposes. So what's important for this in relation to hospital pathway teams or similar discharge projects is that the Care Act sets out and continues the previous rules by confirming that the council that's responsible, the local authority that's responsible for the person in the hospital, is the area that the adult was ordinarily resident in immediately before admission. Or, and this is significant, if there is no settled residence immediately before admission, then the area in which the hospital lies is responsible. Now, the Care Act section United States also lays out dispute resolution processes, which is helpful, and it says as well that decisions around ordinary residents need to be person-centred, which I think many of us will know that sometimes these disputes are not necessarily person-centred, so it's useful to see that there. Now, of course, I mean, the Care Act obviously repeals the whole of the National Assistance Act 1948. But basically, the Care Act fits into a range of legal provisions around no recourse. So basically, in determining care needs, first of all, Section 39 in ordinary residence helps us to understand territorial responsibility. And then the assessment of people's care needs who have no recourse, again, comes under Section 9, the duty to assess, which we talked about a bit earlier on, and Section 8, the forms of care and support that can be provided, that illustrative list we looked at. And in sections 18 and 19, we see duties and powers to meet need. And this is the backdrop for the determination of exclusions under Schedule 3 of the the NIA Act, which is the, help me if anyone knows, the, I know it's an Immigration Act anyway. And also the exceptions determined by the Human Rights Act assessment, which then happen. So the local authority under Section 21 of the Care Act can't meet the needs for care and support where Section 115 of the Immigration and Asylum Act 1999 applies, which is the exclusion of benefits. And this is significant, whose needs for care and support arise solely because of destitution or the physical effects or anticipated physical effects of being destitute. So the Care Act does actually have quite big connotations for people who have no recourse. Yeah, so I'm going to wrap up there just by saying let's talk in the discussion hopefully about the first Care Act case, which basically Haringey were criticised in relation to not providing independent advocacy and also not considering the accommodation-related care and support. They considered NAS-related accommodation, and that was judged not to be okay. And closing thoughts really are that, you know, we do as a sector need to become more familiar with the jargon of the Care Act. Much of the detail depends on case law, which has been slow to roll in, but hopefully, as we saw, the first Care Act judgment includes reference to accommodation-related support. However, whether this amounts to a new deal for homeless people per se is up for discussion. Needs still have to arise from physical or mental health issue. Housing comes before the community before community care, and that's set out in Section 23. But adult social care may end up using its resources in immediate situations, possibly. And again, just we can't say enough about austerity and the potential that has for hampering the uses of the Care Act. Thanks, and sorry I ran over slightly.
We're going to throw it open to the room to ask questions. If you could put your hands up, I'll call you out, and if you could tell us who you are and what organisation you are from, because we're being recorded. Gentleman in the green.
For Lydia. My name's Chris Dutton. I'm a housing worker at the KHP Pathway Homeless Team. And it was just about kind of what was done with the recommendations. Was that put to the DWP, and what was the response from them, I guess?
So we worked with DWP before the report came out, as well as after. We're fairly happy with how they responded in private. So in public, I don't know if you saw any of the coverage, but they did criticise the report when it came out. And ironically, even though we tried to interview, as I said, DWP staff, Job Centre Plus staff, etc., and they wouldn't talk to us. And it's one of the things they criticise us for. In public, but in private, they are talking to us, and we basically gave them the heads up before the report came out. The sanctions team is based in Sheffield, so we went to see them. We had a very long conversation about the findings and the recommendations, and after the report came out again, we went to see them, and they're taking it seriously. So every time they meet us, they have like updates, and they are. So they're very concerned about the issue with housing benefit being stopped because it's not supposed to be happening, and they really are putting a lot of effort in and contacting lots of different teams to see whether they can resolve it. Certain things are clearly out of bounds, like there's no way they're going to do an evaluation, so stuff that comes out in public, I think they're less comfortable with. But certainly, the civil servants are very committed to using the evidence to improve the system, which you know, at the moment, I think that's all we can hope for. But we're actively, going back to them every once in a while and say, so what's been happening? Before it came out, as soon as the study started, almost, and we still have those dialogues, and we have a couple of other outputs from the study coming out later in the year, and again, we'll go through the same, process.
Lady in the yellow jumper.
I'm Sarah, I run a data centre in Brighton for Dr. Hoopers. With Universal Credit coming in, that's just the might be sanctions up to 146 weeks. Can Brighton and Homeless Link lobby against that at all, or are you already?
Definitely. I mean, we will definitely be keeping an eye on how Universal Credit, embeds, and the sanctions is something that, you know, we're not going to stop looking into now. You know, with the changes we're going to carry on. Yeah, exactly. So it's more important than ever.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. We will lobby on, and we are lobbying on it. It's one of the hardest things about doing any kind of lobbying work with the DWP, in my experience, is that they immediately say that their immediate response to most of these issues is that couldn't happen, or that wasn't never our intention, and they hide behind this idea. So even often in the face of evidence, they will say that can't be true, because our rules are that isn't meant to happen. And actually, one of the things that I think a lot of our work is showing really is the difference between the policy intention and what's actually happening in real time on the ground. There does seem to be a really bad the communication between DWP and what's happening on the ground is really poor, and we're often telling them about things they really ought to know that they don't understand, and in particular this concept of unintended consequence, which is a useful kind of campaign tool for us, I think.
But that's the challenge, isn't it? Definitely there's a huge disconnect between policy and practice. But then if the government stop investing in evidence, if you're cynical, you could say that's quite convenient. But that's where we come in. But it's challenging, because we're having to use our own resources to do these very large studies nowadays, studies that the government should be doing. And suddenly, organisations like Crisis need to be doing these studies. And longer term, is it sustainable? But it's definitely, there's a shift going on. And some of it may be conscious, some of it may not be conscious. It's hard to tell. But definitely, when it's so clear that often there's a disconnect between the two, the government have the obligation to be evaluating the impact of its own policies. And it's definitely not doing that at the moment. It's,
Gentleman in the blue shirt.
Thank you. I think it's very interesting to hear what you said. About the benefit sanctions issue. My name is Andrew Humphries. I'm a trustee of a local homelessness charity in Woking in Surrey, the York Road Project. I think that as well as the sort of lobbying and the sort of policy response which is necessary, I think that it's potentially helpful to have local responses as well. I don't know all the details, but what I do know about our experience of this issue in Woking is that when the benefit sanctions sort of regime, if you like, was introduced or ramped up, we experienced all the things that you talked about from your research, such as street homeless, rough sleepers being told they had to spend 30 hours a week online to maintain their benefit, and then losing sort of everything, including their eligibility for housing benefit and all this sort of stuff. So we experienced all of that, and I don't know all the details right now, but I can supply those for people who want it later. What has made a difference is building a relationship with DWP locally, and exactly what you were saying earlier about getting those vulnerability markers put onto cases so that the automatic sanctions aren't applied the minute somebody misses an appointment or has another failure of their compliance. The majority of the clients whom we work with do have those vulnerability markers in place. And so, in a sense, to a large extent, the problem of the unintended policy implications are solved through a local solution. So that obviously relates to Woking, and you alluded to the fact that there are probably some some job centre yourself, so perhaps it's a mixed bag.
I find that you generally, with the DWP, have two sets of rules that apply to two different situations, but will be used by staff depending on what they want the outcome to be,
sure,
to get the outcome they want.
So that, to me, that sounds like individuals or individual job centres, if you like, overreaching their authority to deliberately disadvantage homeless people. So if that's your experience, then I think that's clearly happening. But it does seem that what our experience locally is that it's more along the lines of there wasn't the local intention to unfairly disadvantage homeless people, but it was happening. Mm-hmm. And so when challenged locally, that led to... So I think, yeah, that's always happening in some areas. But so I think, you know, maybe a local response. And it's possible, I think, that with your experience, it's happening at a certain level. And if local homelessness agencies get involved at maybe a slightly higher local level in DWP, some of that could be challenged, you know, through sort of managers, etc. So I think, I suppose I'm making the case for local intervention as well as the vital research that's going on.
Well, that's very good news if you're able to do that.
Lady in the third row.
Thank you. I'm Claire. I'm working on the Panel and Homeless Health Project. Just a practical question. Where does it say that housing benefits should be stopped if someone's JSA has been sanctioned?
It just shouldn't. I think, is it the what?
The reason why I ask is because it's very helpful for people to know. So you know, like you're saying about the Care Act, you should know the lingo, but also if you can sort of say, I know in law or in this policy document, whatever, housing benefit cannot be stopped as a result of sanctions of JSA.
Uh-huh.
In my personal experience, and I know a lot of people this has happened to, housing benefit is means tested. Therefore, if you have your benefits cut off, it should not affect your housing benefit at all. But most local authorities will request that you prove that you have no money. As we all know, you can't prove that you don't have something, you can only prove that you do have something. So therefore, the system is set up in a way that makes it impossible for people to actually continue gaining housing benefit without the proof that they are on a low income of being on an actual state benefit.
It's about communication. There's lots of guidance that you know that the state government can provide that after. But so everyone knows that this shouldn't be happening. Local authorities. It's about communication. I think a lot of the time it's communication between Jobs Centre Plus, local authorities, and something you know goes.
It's because of the change of circumstance. It's because it seems the change of circumstance.
Yeah, exactly.
Then they say, well, we didn't know about a change of circumstance, so we stopped the housing benefit. We should inform us. But really, there's nothing really to inform them because the housing benefit should stay the same.
Sure. Exactly.
So I guess what I'm asking, so that there isn't a line somewhere that says it can't happen. Sorry, I know I sound like a big fanatic, but you know, if someone's trying to challenge it and they can quote and say, it says here, sanctions should not affect housing benefit, they can use that in their appeal and educate the person themselves.
There probably is just that line, and I can come back to you on that. But I think everyone, if you talk to any local authority, Jobs Centre, everyone acknowledges it shouldn't be happening. So it's not as if it's something that will come as a surprise.
Sure.
But,
yes, but it clearly is happening.
Exactly.
And also,
exactly.
Also what I'm hearing, which fits with what you said, Rick, is that people that are working for the UK haven't got a clue what's going on.
Yeah, I think it's worse than that actually. So I've run some of these sessions with the DWP staff around the country, and some of them informally, out of earshot of their bosses, told me that they'd almost been led to believe that applying sanctions was a good thing for them, that they would somehow be praised by their bosses for applying, which is so ridiculous and just, you know, almost scandalous, really, if it's true. And it's only sort of anecdotal, but I do believe that some of the kind of presenting behaviours that homeless people engage in are perceived by the Job Centre staff as being non-compliance. In other words, they think the person's being a pain in the arse, when actually they're not. They're just in the throes of some deep crisis and are struggling to prioritise the various problems and challenges that they're facing. But it's, if you don't understand about homelessness, if you've never had any training or you've no awareness of some of these things, you know, the presenting behaviours often just look as if it's a person being a pain in the arse, and therefore the application sanctions would seem to be legitimate.
I think there's definitely a cultural and training issue, but I think it's also important to remember that the whole system is not geared towards supporting the most vulnerable, as the education system is geared towards the majority. The most vulnerable are not the majority, and which is why the services that, for instance, crisis provides to get people into employment, they are no doubt more expensive than, you know, your average employment services, but that's because you need a different type of support to help these people, you know, homeless people move towards employment and meaningful occupation. It's a very different type of package that you need. And that's why a lot of the time what happens is that services that an organisation like Crisis provides ends up cross-subsidising the work programme. So I think one of the things that needs to be acknowledged is that, yes, staff a lot of the time are not doing a good job, but there's bigger problems at stake as well. There's structural issues with the system, and maybe that it's a time to acknowledge that even if more expensive, you need a different type of support for these individuals.
Absolutely. But I'll say again, I think if you've got it written down that this is illegal to do so, you need to tell the person, because you're not going to sort of change the structural things, unfortunately.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
yeah. Whereas if you know your legal rights, then
yeah,
you can.
Yeah.
Yes, we have 4 minutes left.
Oh, okay, I've got two on my iPad, so that's even better. Thank you, really useful presentations. Carl, I wish I had that presentation a year ago, because I can really think of half a dozen cases I could have applied that to. So I've just a couple of points. I'm Zana, I'm the GP for the homeless team, currently on maternity leave. Put a caveat to that. For Guy's and St Thomas's in SLAM. From a health point of view, it really concerns me that... what I repeatedly have seen over the last 2 years in my job is appraisals of people's health by people who are inappropriately trained to make a judgment about their health. Just yesterday, again, some of a caseworker from Housing Options asking about an HIV-positive patient's CD4 count because documents that we've managed to get on the sly through another person on our team who I won't directly look at, say that if the CD4 count is above a certain level, then they are not deemed priority need. The CD4 count is the white cell. So if it's below a certain level, they're considered to be at risk, and if it's above a certain level, they're not considered to be at risk and therefore not priority need. Of course, it's nonsense, because if you're HIV positive, you're at risk of severe and life-threatening infections on a continuous and ongoing basis for the rest of your life. So, you know, things like that do really concern me, and it worries me that somebody is being turned away or sanctioned from their benefits as a result of them being hospitalised. So I just wonder, Leslie, is there anything that you've discussed with the Department of Work and Pensions around things that we can do as clinicians to make sure that it is very clear, and particularly with the introduction of universal credit, I'm really concerned that people are going to be with long-term health conditions, they're going to be...
I think that's there's a study in there, you know, because it just reminded me of what you just said. Just reminded me of a couple of other pieces of work that I was involved in different ways. So the mystery shopping that we did last year of local authorities, and seriously, medical evidence is really not rated. That's the reality, and because I spent months afterwards talking to local authorities about the evidence, and if there's one thing they all agreed in, and the better local authorities was, you know, you can't really take medical evidence that seriously because they're biased. You know, they're always, you know, on the side of the patient. So I heard that again and again, and this is even from the better authorities. And then the other one is a study, a really interesting study that was done by Sarah Johnson and a law professor at York. Not that long ago, looking into this, looking at how housing officers looked at medical evidence. And sadly, there's no output, there's no report that's come out on this, but you could get in touch with them. But again, they gathered very good evidence about the fact that they felt there were the housing officers that were better qualified to look at medication, etc., that they could basically just look at what they want is not your opinion. What they want is, okay, what medication did you give to this patient? And based on that medication, I'll decide how real this person is. So they found that, and so did I, in the conversations I had. That's all they wanted. They wanted a record of all the medication, etc., the history that patients have. They do not want letters from
from a doctor. So I think there's definitely a really interesting piece of work to be done around how can medical professionals influence. Maybe you can do something
like,
yeah,
I mean, I use that priority need document to make sure that my, not that my patients fall into priority need, but to make sure that they are, that I'm documenting things in a way that ensures that they are seen to be priority need. I have a little question for Carl as well, just around timelines. I mean, looking at what the Care Act has to do, it seems like a lot more people fall into the remit now of being eligible for a Care Act assessment, but the timelines for decisions and assessments seem to be taking a long time. Is there any obligation on assessments to take place within a certain period of time?
No, not that I can think of. Although obviously, from within a hospital, the hospital discharge guidelines still are still there. So the use of what was the Section 2 and the Section 5, which is now the assessment notice and the discharge notice, they still provide a time frame. But also, I meant to say Section. I can't remember the section, but there is an ability to provide a service. Without an assessment if urgent need is there, and there's a section that looks at urgent need, so that is possible from a community point of view. But within the hospital, the same timelines exist as before, that hasn't changed. So it's about getting your notices in a timely way. It's about good discharge planning processes, and it's about educating the ward staff that you're working with, particularly with homeless people who've got much more challenging needs, and they're not needs that necessarily are the same as the older person who's had a fall, who's living with her husband in a house. It's very, very, very different needs. So particularly where there's complex assessments required, it's about getting that Section 2 in quite good time and communicating with social services to let them know about what the complexities are before they come up and do their assessment on the ward.
Unfortunately, that is all the time we have now. If we could give a nice big round of applause to Lindsay and Kay.
Some copies of Leisha's report up on the front here.
Oh, it's a big one.
Wow, that's
long.
We'll take one with your list.
Yeah.
I'll take this for the team. I'll take this for the team.
Yeah, stumpy, doesn't that?
Don't drop it on your foot. That's it.